Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program today, Cyril Ramaphosa heads to Washington as President Trump slams the brakes on G20 talks. Israel unleashes its deadliest Gaza assault to date as hospitals and aid routes are hit. The South African Defence Force in crisis as funding cuts gut military capability. And a South African painting fetches a record 246 million rand in a global art sale. It's Monday, the 19th of May. Now, I don't need to tell you that tensions between South Africa and the United States have escalated, with Washington placing a freeze on any G20 collaboration. All of this coming as President Ramaphosa now embarks on a working visit to the United States. I guess the big question this week is this meeting going to move the needle at all? Is it going to change anything? And I want to talk now to Dr. Lawrence Karomba, researcher in humanities at the Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection. Lawrence, a very warm welcome to you. And one's got to ask, I suppose, can the president realistically reset this relationship, or do you think the window is already closed?
Actually, I think that he can. I think that Trump is a very unpredictable figure. And, you know, like sometimes he changes his positions on things. And this is one of kind of the strange things about studying diplomacy in the age of Trump, that, I mean, as much as his foreign policy is unpredictable and sometimes irrational in the sense that he seems to believe certain things that are kind of objectively not true, at the same time, he's willing to take risks and he's willing to depart from doing things the way that things were done in the past. And this can have unpredictable consequences. And we see this in the case of, for example, U.S. negotiations with Iran, which are going, I think, surprisingly well, like better than a lot of observers of international politics would have expected. So there definitely is room for a turnaround. But I think it would have to, obviously, you need to have an understanding of what South Africa's goals are. And South Africa needs to approach these negotiations in a careful way, looking at some of the bad examples that have happened in the past, like, you know, obviously the meeting between Trump and Zelensky, for example, is a good illustration of how we do not want this to go.
As they sit down in what will obviously be a very public meeting, do we have any leverage in terms of this bilateral relationship? In other words, what does the United States want from us?
Yeah, so I think there's two things, right? First of all, there is the issue of trade, right? Where I think the United States wants to, it seems to me like the United States wants to move away from AGOA and switch to some sort of bilateral trade deal with South Africa. And that seems like that's something that we're looking to do as well. So there might be a kind of alignment of interests there. But then the other thing is that international politics, you can kind of think of from a strategic point of view, or from a game theory point of view, as a two-level game. So there's two things that are going on. The one is governments are negotiating with each other, but at the same time, each government is also trying to maintain support from its domestic support base, right? So there's this like domestic political game that's going on at the same time. And a lot of what Trump does is he makes deals on the international stage that seem to be calculated to give him wins or deals or things that he can take into the domestic context in the United States and say, look, I'm winning, I'm making deals, I'm a successful president. So I think where there is scope for South Africa to make concessions, the ideal situation from a South African perspective would be if we can give him almost symbolic wins that he can take to his domestic audience and say, look, I've got South Africa to concede on this and this and this, but it's not such a big deal for us. It's largely a symbolic thing. But if we can get more concrete concessions in return that will actually benefit the country, that would be the ideal outcome. And whether that's actually possible, obviously is uncertain. But I think that's the strategic approach that our government is hopefully thinking about.
Practically, though, isn't this meeting going to be completely overshadowed by the arrival of the 49 so-called refugees?
Yeah, so this is the issue of, I think it would be beneficial in South Africa's interests to try to downplay this issue as much as possible. So yes, this will be the focus of media attention, but we need to focus on what our real strategic goals are, right? Because our first one is we want to maintain our status of non-alignment in this kind of global great power competition that's going on between the US and China. So to do that, we kind of need to get off Trump's list of enemy countries, right? We need to convince him that we're a neutral participant and we're not his enemy. And then our more narrow short-term or medium-term goal is that we want to negotiate some sort of trade agreement to replace AGOA, because I think it's clear that AGOA is not going to be around for forever. And it behooves us as a sort of middle-income country to be able to negotiate bilateral trade deals, right? Not just to rely on one-sided deals from other countries, which is what AGOA is. So these are our real strategic goals, and I think that's what we need to focus on. And if we can kind of shift the discussion away from the refugees, but from a South African perspective, people can choose to leave the country. We do not accept the status of refugees, but at the same time, we're not like forcing people to stay who don't want to stay. So it need not be an issue of contention.
What is at stake for South Africa if this visit doesn't result in a thaw in relations?
Like I said before, the example of a bad scenario would be something similar to what we saw with the Zelensky meeting, where Trump and his team kind of ambushed a visiting head of state, and used him to score points for their domestic audience, and that would be the worst case scenario immediately that South Africa is trying to avoid, which would then set a pattern for worsened relations in the future. We could look at South Africa being locked out of US markets for trade, and we could see the emergence of a kind of permanent, almost like a permanent hostile relationship, similar to what we see with the US and its relationships with countries like Iran, for example, where there's this continual pattern of conflict. But that's definitely not in a South African interest, and I don't think that's in a I don't think that's in the US interest either. Remember, South Africa has things that we can offer, right? I mean, we have things like access to critical mineral supplies, which the US needs, as part of its long-term great power game. It doesn't want to be reliant on China for things like critical mineral supplies. So there is scope for South Africa to offer things to the US as well. But we need to couch these arguments in the sort of things that Trump responds to, which is transactional deal making, giving him symbolic wins that he can take to his supporters, not trying to lecture him on morality, because unfortunately, I think it's been shown previously that that's not a successful negotiating tactic, and it's unlikely to work.
And that meeting takes place midweek. Dr. Lawrence Karomba, thank you very much indeed from the Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection. I do appreciate your time and your insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in the past couple of days, Israel launching its most intense military operation since the conflict reignited. Around 130 people dead, hospitals were targeted, and aid has been cut off. As Gaza burns and diplomacy stalls, I guess the next question is, what is next as far as this region's deadly chapter is concerned? I'm in conversation now with Zinat Adam, who is Deputy Executive Director at the Afro-Middle East Center. Zinat, a very warm welcome to you, and maybe just your assessment. What provoked this latest and deadliest escalation in Gaza, and how do you see it playing out over the next couple of days?
Hello, Jeremy. Yes, I think that we're on day 600 of the war in Gaza, and it's really reaching a point of escalation with the new Operation Gideon's Chariot that's been launched by Israel. Very telling that it calls on biblical terms in order to try and cast its operations within that light. What appears to be happening is that they're creating additional corridors to try and cut off Palestinians in Gaza from each other, and creating these buffer zones, or what they're determining as humanitarian zones, that effectively become extermination areas and zones along these borders, pushing the Palestinians into enclaves. The starving of the Palestinians for more than 2 months has been really very difficult, not just on the ground, but internationally, with the pressure that has come from the international community asking them to allow for humanitarian aid. Last night, we heard that this would be allowed, but with specific parameters. From the diplomatic side, what we're witnessing is that the mediators in Qatar have indicated that there was a lot of progress in the last few weeks with the hope that the hostages would all be released in terms of the deal that was struck with the Israeli-American captive Eden Alexander being released, but that Israel was unhappy that the Americans were dealing with this directly, and as a result, they determined that they would not be involved in those discussions.
It would seem, though, that the international response, particularly to the attacks on hospitals and aid routes, has been lackluster, to say the least.
Certainly, they haven't done anything to apply significant pressure on Israel in order to allow that humanitarian aid into these areas, in absolute violation of international law. And whilst there have been statements coming from the international community, it really hasn't done much in order to ensure that the Palestinians have received the very, very basic needs that they have. And we've seen footage of children actually starving from the famine that has resulted. But it doesn't appear that there is much to be done. We did see last week this pomp and ceremony around Trump's visit to the Gulf region and a lot of money pledged to the United States, of course, considering that Trump is a deal maker. And I think that part of this, certainly in the Qatari light, was the hope that Trump would then apply pressure on Israel and that they would be able to shift this towards a new narrative. I understand that there are a number of options that have been put on the table. The one that seems to be gaining the most traction from a mediation perspective is that Hamas would no longer administer the Gaza Strip, that would go to either the Palestinian Authority or a new entity, and that there would be a possibility of rebuilding this. Now, yesterday, this was put on the table, and Hamas was asking for at least a 5-year truce in exchange for the hostages, but it appears that Israel has not taken the bait on this one. Instead, they're holding on to the ideas of the relocation of all Palestinians. The latest has been to Libya. Previously, we've heard that they would have wanted them to be relocated to places like Rwanda or along the borders in Egypt and Jordan, and that is not something palatable to the Palestinians or the Arabs.
In spite of that, do you hold out any optimism for a short to medium term solution here, or does this current operation that we've been talking about potentially spell the death knell for any viable peace process?
I think that there's a few things to consider when we look at the short-term negotiations. The one is that Israel is finding itself increasingly isolated from the international community. And in the last few weeks, there's a rift that has built between Trump and Netanyahu, not necessarily between Israel and the United States. I draw a differentiation between those two. And this really has emanated from the United States going ahead with direct negotiations with the Houthis or the Ansarullah in Yemen and with Hamas in the case of the American captive Eden Alexander, and even in the approach towards the situation with Iran. And this has irked Netanyahu. Now, his whole premise is that his political career is bent on having a war. And so it appears that he's upscaled this war in these few weeks since this rift with America. In conjunction with that, you have the international community applying increased pressure and the isolation, but Israel's response has been lifting the pressure on Palestinians.
Just a final question. Do you think this issue is likely to come up in any talks between President Ramaphosa and Donald Trump in Washington this week?
I think that part of the discussions in Washington would certainly touch on the ICJ case, and that President Ramaphosa would have to be very firm about our support for Palestinians, because if the conditions placed by Trump for resolving the situation between South Africa and the United States would be related to the Palestinian issue, we shouldn't necessarily be backing down specifically on the ICJ case. I think that we have a moral responsibility to see that through.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Inad Adam, Deputy Executive Director at the Afro Middle East Center.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
It would seem the South African National Defence Force is being hollowed out, not by enemies, but by money, the budget. A slow, steady defunding has left the military stretched, demoralised, and in many cases, under-equipped. So my question is, what are the risks of a weakened force in an unstable region? I'm in conversation with defence commentator, analyst and writer Dean Wingren. Dean, welcome. And first of all, how severe is the current defunding of the SANDF? And maybe just tell me where it's being felt most acutely.
Hi, Jeremy, and thanks for having me. And you are so right. The Defence Force has been defunded so much that it's actually taken it to a really critical point. And if you think that the last defence review we had was in 2015, and since then, the Defence Force has had baseline cuts every single year, not only in nominal terms, but in real terms, taking inflation into account as well. So in 2015, it was already recognized that the Defence Force budget was not sufficient. And yet the Defence Force was proposed and structured based on a further funding for the Defence Force. But what's actually happened is, you know, as funding has decreased, it's had a severe impact on the capability of the Defence Force, not only on its current weapon systems, but it's preventing the modernization of those systems, as well as cuts in its actual personnel. So as the president allocates more and more responsibilities to the Defence Force, things like providing bridges in rural areas, protecting power stations, combating gangsterism in certain townships and illegal miners. These are all good things to do, but it's taken away from the core function of the Defence Force. And it's simply not sustainable, and it's having a severe impact on the Defence Force to do what it's mandated to do, and that is to protect the borders of South Africa.
And so as a result of that observation, I would imagine that the national security risk of an under-resourced defence force increases incrementally.
Exactly. When you look at what has happened to the army, you know, it's got 196 capabilities of core capabilities, and it's only capable of doing 126 of those. You look at the Air Force, out of the total aircraft of about 200 aircraft in its inventory, it's only got about between 15 and 20 flying on any particular day. So that means it's got a reduced budgeted flying hours of 12,000 flying hours per year, and it's only able to do 6,800 of those. It's the same with the Navy. It's only able to go to sea for 2,400 hours a year instead of its budgeted 8,000. And these budgeted hours are even less than what it should be doing. And you look at the military health service, the hospitals are in a terrible state, and there's a severe shortage of professional staff, so that a lot of the patients and the Defense Force personnel actually have to be outsourced to private practitioners at an increased cost. So it's having an impact on the Defense Force that is almost beyond the point of easy repair.
Do you think the defunding can be reversed, or are we at a point now where the decline, as you've outlined to me, is now structural?
It definitely has become structural at the moment, where you can throw money at the Defence Force at the moment, and it will not really help it in the short term. Since about 2015, they've had baseline cuts of about 49 billion rand. Now, the Defence Force's budget is about 0.8% of our GDP, where it should be about 1.5% or even 2%, which is sort of the international norm now. And when you think of NATO, now wants to go to about 4 to 5%. Now, obviously, that's a bit high for South Africa's case, given our socioeconomic scenario. And even with our GDP in South Africa, it's such a small growth that, South Africa cannot actually sustain an increased defense force of about 1.5%. So, what I suggest is that the defense force's budget be slowly increased, at least to 1% for about 2 or 3 years, and then 1.2%, and gradually raise it to 1.5%. And that is just because, so, whatever additional money can be intelligently allocated to the correct resource that's required to be repaired. And that if you just throw too much money at it, it's just going to be lost. And you can compare it to a starving person who hasn't had food for a long time. They're so undernourished that just throwing food at them will actually probably make them worse. You have to slowly, slowly feed them the correct nutrition. And I'm not a doctor, but feed them the correct nutrition so they can grow and strengthen properly. And that, I'm afraid, is what's going to have to happen with our Defence Force, because it's reached such a stage that even if you just suddenly increase the budget, it would be such a shock to the system that I'm afraid there'd be even more wasteful expenditure.
Dean, just a final one, and very quickly, who should be held accountable for the strategic neglect? Is it Treasury? Is it the Defense Department itself? Or is it more nuanced than that?
That's a very good question. In theory, it should be the ruling party and cabinet and the president who directs where the money should be allocated to and the priorities. And then Treasury will then see, is that a responsible spending, and allocate the funds in a responsible manner to that. At the moment, it appears that Treasury might actually be driving the cart and sort of stepping in and saying, no, we deem other priorities are more important. And as I said, South Africa's got important socioeconomic things like health and safety and that kind, and education, and those are certainly priorities, but it shouldn't come at the such an expense to defense, where it's South Africa is now using the Defense Force as a crutch for all the other failing SOEs and State Department, yet they're being defunded at such a rate.
Dean Wingren, thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate your time and your analysis.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A South African masterpiece has shattered records. Marlene Dumas' oil painting has just sold for a jaw-dropping 246 million rand. So my question is, what makes this work so valuable and what does it say about the global hunger, the appetite for African art? I'm in conversation now with Wilhelm van Rensburg, Senior Art Specialist, Head Curator at Strauss & Company. Wilhelm, a very warm welcome to you. And what is it about the specific painting that has commanded such a high price?
Look, Jeremy, thanks for having me on your show. I think it is, number one, she is a woman artist, and number two, the subject matter. Now, up to now, women artists have really had a bad time on the global art market. It's usually the bad artists who are commanding prices. And so she is one of a handful of international artists, Yayoi Kusama, Cindy Sherman, Bridget Lyley, and the like. And they get up to about 10 million pounds on auction. So I'm elated that Marlene Dumas' work has fetched such high prices. Now, the other thing is the subject matter. And here they are addressing completely different subject matter. You know, contemporary art deals with identity, the fashioning of new subjectivity. And Miss January, the title of this particular work, is based on a sex worker that she found in a magazine that she depicted in 1997. So, you know, shedding light, turning away from what they call the male gaze. I think all of these things combine to make her work so delectable.
Wilhelm, I understand a lot of this is done confidentially, but are you able to tell me whether there was intense international bidding and maybe even who the main contenders were?
Strange enough, the estimates were 12 to 16 million only fetched, you know, with a commission 13.8. So my reading of this is that there were probably just one bidder. And in all likelihood, museums. So museums have these gaps in their collections, and in all likelihood, it is going to a big museum.
How does this sale, Wilhelm, position South African art now on the global stage? Does it send out a new message?
Hopefully so. You know, Strauss & Company, for who I work, is the best one on the African continent, and our estimates are very reasonable in comparison with these astronomically high prices. But I think the message sent out to the world is that we produce absolutely quality stuff. You know, you will also remember in March this year, Lisa Bryce sold her work for $2.9 million in Sotheby's, New York, and she's also South African. Born and bred. So I think there's value in what South African artists, especially women artists, can deliver on the contemporary art market.
And this could no doubt lead to a bigger global investment trend in African contemporary art, no doubt.
Absolutely. You know, there are many contemporary African art fairs throughout the world. We have the foremost Museum of Contemporary Art in Cape Town, the Zuid-Snoka. There are many publications, and so, you know, the spotlight is really on Africa and the contemporary art that it produces.
When you conclude a sale like this, Wilhelm, does it have an immediate ripple effect for emerging South African artists?
Not really so. You know, it is sort of like a rank order. You know, there is a sort of like an hierarchy. So sort of like a new up-and-coming young black artists, women artists, for instance, can't expect the same. You know, they have to build up stature first and have a good footprint in the auction world on a secondary market, and then we can look at comparable prices.
Is there concern about major works leaving the continent permanently?
Okay, so say for instance a work is bought by an overseas collector and the work has to leave South Africa, there is a process, a permit has to be obtained for export. Just to give you a good example, one of Irma Stern's Arab works sold to a museum in Qatar, and the condition for export was that the work has to come back every 5 years for a period of time to be exhibited here. That particular Arab portrait was then shown at the opening exhibition of the Javid Foundation in Pretoria, but it is now back, you know. So it's not just a heritage work that can leave left, right and center haphazardly. It has to go through a process, a permit has to be obtained.
And just a final one, there is a lot of excitement, I understand, about the upcoming auction of Tretyakov's famous Chinese girl.
Absolutely, you know, all eyes are on that. You will know that Tretyakov, you know, is known for his reproductions. For he sold millions and millions of prints, especially of this, it's called Woman of the East. She is a local model. He actually used a shopkeeper's daughter, a 21-year-old daughter in Cape Town, as his model. But the work is called The Woman of the Orient, and it has been reproduced on bags, on cushions, posters, and what have you. So it is quite an iconic work and quite a privilege to have the real thing on sale.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. That's Wilhelm von Rensburg, Senior Art Specialist, Head Curator at Strauss & Company. And that is also today's edition of MoneyWeb at Midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.